History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. They really don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it before it's too late. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We hope to preserve their stories so the rest of us never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we find ourselves educated, we're always entertained, and we truly are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It is no secret that our World War II generation is leaving us. Nationally, only an estimated 45,000 of the nearly 16.5 million Americans who served in World War II are still with us today. And we just lost a very special member of that generation when Floyd Thomason took his final breath in Jackson, Tennessee. Floyd was one of our last living witnesses to the Doolittle Raid, among other historic moments. And while we believe there are only 11 Pearl Harbor survivors still alive here in 2026, Floyd was one who was out to sea during the attack, but came back into the harbor on December 8, 1941. Floyd had celebrated his 102nd birthday in February. We met him in Lewiston, Idaho, not long after he had reached the century mark, and his mind was as crystal clear as ever. As his 3 daughters, 9 grandchildren, 16 great-grandchildren, and 13 great-great-grandchildren celebrate Easter this weekend, they can reflect on how their own existence required Floyd surviving some extreme situations as a teenager in the early days of World War II. And today's episode will serve as a tribute to his remarkable life.
I was the third child of my parents, and I was born in a little town west of Eugene, Oregon. We were only there about 2 years until my dad and my mom started moving around the country and finding work wherever they could until we wound up all the way over in Idaho. And that's the beginning of my life.
And that's Gooding, Idaho. Tell everybody where that is and how big a place that was in the 20s.
Well, that is down the next closest town to that would have been Jerome, Idaho. Gooding was probably 2,000 people there. It was just a little farming community. So my dad and mom finally found an old cattle ranch that had, because of taxes or the people moved off of it, they couldn't pay the taxes on it, and my dad was able to do that, and we moved into an old shack that was there, and that was the beginning of my life on a cattle ranch. It wasn't a large ranch. It was just, I suppose we had 45, 50 head of cattle. I think we had more horses than we had cattle because Dad was a horse trader. So that's the way we got started out there on that ranch. So I was the third child. I have 2 sisters that are older than I am, and one of them is still living. So we were 4 miles from the nearest country school, and we had to ride the horses or walk. Winter and summer, and pretty tough going at times, but we still managed to get there and get back home. And the school was, like I say, it was a little country school, and all 8th grades were taught in that same little school.
And it's still standing today?
The schoolhouse was moved into Gooding, the town of Gooding, at the fairgrounds. It was on display because it was an old antique building. And that's where I got my education, to the 8th grade. I graduated the 8th grade.
Well, and I know this is a long time ago, but I'm always interested to know if you can remember your perspective back then, what it might have been like, because the world was a pretty different place in the 20s and 30s. Do you remember as that boy having some ambitions, some hopes and dreams of, hey, when I grow up, this is who I'm going to be or what I'm going to do?
I really never thought that much ahead. All of us boys, I had 4 brothers, and we were all cowboys because of our lifestyle. And so I'm the last of the old-time cowboys, I guess, the way they trailed cattle out on the range and forded rivers with them, and we laid out on the prairie with a saddle for a pillow and a saddle blanket over us at night and our six guns handy to keep the coyotes off of us, and that was the lifestyle that we had. And I never really thought much about any other part of the world until my cousin, his name was Roy Lakey, mentioned that he would like to join the Navy and see the world and wanted to know if I'd go along with him. And, of course, I'm ready to do most anything and to be different. And so the two of us joined the Navy, and that's where we spent our wartime years.
Yeah, and we're going to talk a lot about that. But before we dive further into that, I'm just wondering if you can give us a little perspective on those Depression years and what the reality really was, because so many people today, I mean, kids today have a smartphone everywhere they go. I know you didn't have one of those, but can you give us a sense of what day-to-day life was like and the things that stand out in your memory about those years?
Well, I can kind of fill you in on a daily basis. During the time that we were going to school, it was our obligation to get up and do the chores, to milk the cows and feed all the livestock and gather the eggs and whatever's necessary on the farm to keep it going. Then we had breakfast and packed our lunch and went to school for the day, and that was our daily activities. Of course, we never had much back in those days. Money was pretty scarce. Dad had to do quite a bit of work for some of the neighbors in order to have a few dollars to buy groceries with. But my mother had a big garden, and so we grew most of the stuff, whatever we needed on a daily basis to keep the kids all fed and everything. So that's the way the day started. So that's a perspective on what our daily activity was like.
Yeah, and you mentioned sleeping out on the prairie and what your pillow was and what the scenes were. And I saw a photo of you as, I guess, maybe a teenager holding up a snake that's as tall as you are. Was that a pretty common thing to encounter out there?
Yeah, that was pretty common. When we first moved on to the ranch, there was just rattlesnakes everywhere. So it took a while to get rid of all the snakes around the place. My dad bought probably a half a dozen, maybe a dozen pigs and turned them loose out there, and they took care of the snake problem that we had. But our neighbors were no better off than we were at that time, so we helped each other at harvest time when it's time to put up the hay and harvest the grain and stuff like that, you know. And so that was the life that we lived. Everybody was poor, never had any money, and so it was just help each other and to do the things that was necessary to keep the ranches going.
And when you have seven siblings, I just have to ask the question, how'd you get along with all those brothers and sisters?
Well, we were a pretty tight-knit group. We all loved one another. That was one of the things that I look back on and wonder how in the world we did get along so good. But I guess it was good teaching from our parents.
Well, and that was the other question I wanted to ask you, and trying to put myself in your shoes during those years. Is there something you look back on and really admire, respect, or appreciate about your parents and how they handled all that?
Well, they were very loving parents. All the kids took the punishment that was necessary whenever we did something wrong. So, I mean, my dad wasn't a mean father, but he was an educational guy. And so that's the way he reprimanded us. And so I remember that very well.
So your cousin Roy says, hey, let's join the Navy. And this is before America has entered World War II. When did you guys go in?
When he suggested that we join the Navy, we went to Twin Falls, Idaho, and they had a recruiting station there. I was only 16 years old, and I had to be 17 to join the Navy. And so we signed all the paperwork, and it was about 3 months later before I was 17 years old on the 4th of February of 1941. And so we went back over at that time and finished up the paperwork and got started and wound up down in Salt Lake City where the recruitment was finalized. And so we went from there to San Diego, California, where we had all of our boot camp training.
So I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes again. So you're 17 years old, Had you ever been on a ship before?
I had never been on a ship before. I'd never seen the ocean before. When we pulled into San Diego, we could look out and see the ocean, and I just thought there can't be that much water in the world. But I'd never seen anything that large.
Well, I'm just going to go out on a limb and guess that if you grew up in rural Idaho on a ranch with rattlesnakes and coyotes and horses and cattle and all that, that Navy training didn't throw you any curveballs you couldn't handle?
Well, it was pretty tough right to begin with, but we got accustomed to it. And I guess you could say that's where I got my first training in the Navy, was there at San Diego, what they call the boot camp. And then after 6 weeks of that, we were reassigned to other places.
And most of the guys I've interviewed over the years, they might have gone in with a buddy, thinking they might get to serve with that buddy, and then they get split up and sent here, there, and everywhere. But you and Roy actually got assigned to the same crew?
Yeah, we got assigned to the same ship. After I got through with my boot training there, then my next job was running the dry dock. It was a dry dock on rails that went out into the water, and it got lower and lower and lower all the time as it went back out. And then we pulled the destroyers. That was the ships that we handled there at the destroyer base all the time. And they had to have periodic cleaning and maintenance. And I was assigned to operate the machinery to bring those ships in and dry dock them. I had one day of training on that job, and then it was turned over to me, and I was the only one there, and I wondered, well, where's my help? But I guess I figured I didn't need it. So it was a good experience anyway, and then I did that until I was reassigned to the Northampton, which was over in Hawaii at the time. It was in dry dock over there getting refitted with different things. And so Roy and I both stayed together all through the war. And so it took us, we got onto an old Liberty ship and hauling troops back and forth across the ocean, and it took us 6 days to get over there. One of the things that I remember about that trip over there, that I got seasick, and I was that way for the whole 6 days of traveling on that ship. The only thing that I could eat was soda crackers and dill pickles. And other than that, we finally got there, you know, and then got assigned to to Northampton, which is a heavy cruiser. So my experience of sea duty began at that time.
Well, and just have to ask you that sidebar question, since you told us about that first ocean voyage and getting seasick. How do you feel about saltine crackers and dill pickles now?
I still like them pretty much, yeah. They're good to have occasionally. I wouldn't say that they're a kind of a food that you have as a daily diet. but they're still good.
And did that cure you of the seasickness, or did it get you again later on?
I never got seasick again after that, just that one time.
So you're put on the Northampton, as you said, a heavy cruiser. What was your duty aboard ship, and how often did you get to see your cousin?
Oh, I saw my cousin probably on a daily basis. We had different duties aboard ship. It could be just to stand watch, or it might be kitchen duties, peeling potatoes, scrubbing the decks, painting something that needed a little paint job on it, you know, that had rusted through. And just repair work is mostly what we had to do until the war broke out. It was pretty much fun.
Well, and that was my next question. Did you get to enjoy any of Oahu or the surrounding area before America got drawn into the war?
Yes, we did. We got to see quite a bit of Honolulu and all the nightlife and everything. And so one of my greatest remembrances, I guess you could say, would be the nightclub life. And we got acquainted with Hilo Hattie. So she was in our crowd all the time. And when the clubs closed, why, she wanted to take Roy home with her. And then I had to convince her that Roy had to go back to the ship. We had a lot of fun with that lady, though.
And here I thought she just made macadamia nut candies.
Oh, yeah. She passed away some time ago. Last time I was in Hawaii, wanted to see if I could find her, and then they told me that she had passed away, so I didn't get to see her.
I know it's a long time ago, and a lot has happened since. But do you remember how much of an awareness you had about the tensions in the world and whether war was imminent or not? What was your thought at the time?
I had no idea that war was imminent. It just didn't keep up with the world news. So it came as a big surprise to me.
And tell me about that. You guys were out to sea with the Enterprise, I believe, when the Japanese showed up, right?
Yeah, that's right. They had loaded a bunch of airplanes on the Enterprise aircraft carrier. They hauled them over to one of the other islands out there. So we were on our way back to Pearl Harbor when the Japanese bombed it. And we were supposed to been in the harbor at that time. But we got into a heavy storm out at sea on the way back. And then we ran low on fuel for the ship. So during the refueling, one of the sailors threw a big hawser over the side that had broken. And it went down and got tangled in our propellers. That held us up another day. So after all of that, we got back in on the 8th of December. And that was really a terrible thing to see. All of the ships that had been damaged and laying on their sides and beached on the beaches there, and some of them were sunken completely, and all the airplane hangars and the airplanes were burning, and of course dead bodies floating in the ocean, in the bay there around through the ships. And it just made you want to cry, you know. Here I am 17 years old, and from a farm back in Idaho, and I had never been around that kind of experience, and it really hit me pretty hard. It made your heart beat a little faster.
I can't even imagine how jarring to the senses that must have been. And I don't know if you can answer this or not, but because you described all the factors outside of your control that prevented your ship from being in the harbor that day, have you ever thought about that? What might have happened to you, to your cousin, to other guys aboard your ship if you had been there on December 7th?
I'm sure we would have probably been damaged by the bombs that were dropped by the Japanese onto all of the ships that were in the harbor at that time.
And you just told me, you know, looking at that made you want to cry. Were there other emotions that scene, that awareness brought to mind for you?
Well, the other emotions that you have is you wonder what the future holds for you from that point on. You have no idea what's going to happen. They could have put us on other ships or transferred us to a station someplace, a land base. You just never knew what the future was.
And I've talked to quite a few Pearl Harbor survivors and others that were on Oahu at the time, and one of the things they mentioned was the real concern or fear that there was going to be an invasion there, that the Japanese were going to try to land troops and take over the island. Did you have any concerns, wonders about what's going to hit us next?
I never even thought about that. I guess we were too busy with other things. And I know that I had heard later on that the Japanese could have had invasion troops with them, but we didn't know that.
So what did they have you doing for the days following that day of infamy?
Well, from the time that we pulled into Pearl Harbor there, that next duty was to take on supplies and ammunition, different guns, and get ready for wartime, I guess. And so we were busy doing that all the time and preparing the ship for that period of time. So it was several days before we were able to go back out to sea again.
And in less than a year, he'd be surviving the sinking of his own ship. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come on this special episode of Hometown Heroes, honoring the legacy of Floyd Thomason on this Easter weekend. He passed away March 24th at the age of 102. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties, and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and an episode today to remember and honor the legacy of Floyd Thomason, whose earthly journey concluded March 24th at the age of 102. A Navy veteran of World War II who endured more in the first year of the war than most of us will encounter in our entire lives. When we left off, we were hearing his memories of coming back into Pearl Harbor on December 8th, 1941.
And you described so vividly, you know, some of the things that were assaulting your eyes in that harbor that were just so shocking and hard to fathom. What the rest of the country saw, the mainland, after that, a lot of them saw singular images, the Arizona burning or the Shaw exploding or maybe just a tattered flag burning in the smoke and those three words underneath, remember Pearl Harbor. There was a rallying cry throughout the country back here stateside. I'm wondering for you, though, was there some fervor among the troops of, hey, the enemy did this to us and now we've got to go back and do something to them?
Yes, that was the opinion of most everybody on the ships. So when we get back in shape and condition to where we can travel again out to sea, we're going to go beat the heck out of them and do to them what they did to us here. And that was our objective. Everybody thought the same way about that.
Well, and I know you'd be part of some situations where that took place in 13 different engagements that you participated in the war, but what was the first one? What was the first experience for you in that actual conflict? You saw the aftermath at Pearl Harbor, but then I'm sure you got to experience some of those kinds of things firsthand. What do you remember about that?
It's kind of hard to describe the feeling that you have. We went back out to sea and started bombing and shelling some of the islands that the Japanese had occupied, and it took us quite a while to kind of take over all of that and to get it back under our control again. I think probably the first one that I remember was our journey to Tokyo. We didn't go to Tokyo, but we were escorting ships when Jimmy Doolittle took the bombers to Tokyo and bombed Tokyo, and that was the first engagement. And so then the next big one was Midway.
Well, let me ask you about that. Did you actually see any of those B-25s taken off the deck?
Yes, I watched every one of them take off. Our ship was right next to the Hornet when they were taken off from the Hornet.
And this is something that had never happened before. A bomber had never flown off the deck of a carrier before. So was that a big deal for you guys on your ship? Could people believe it was happening? What was kind of the scuttlebutt or the whispers aboard the Northampton?
We had a pretty good idea of what was happening, and we got the full story of how those bombers became able to take off of that carrier. They stripped them down to where there was hardly anything left but the seats to sit on, because they needed to have the bombs, all the bombs on them that they could when they went to Tokyo. They practiced for a long time on land, and they got it down to where they only needed 500 feet to take off of. So we were aware of that pretty much. We watched them take off in rough seas, and some of those planes would just almost go into the water. They get so low we thought they were going to, you know, and here we're lifting them up all the time. Come on, lift up, go, get up, you know. And so every one of them managed to get up into the air and form the formations and take off.
Yeah, and of course we know now they had to leave earlier than they planned to because they'd been spotted by the Japanese, and there's so many little parts of that story. But when you think of those men, General Doolittle and all the guys who flew with them that day, the courage it must have taken knowing they couldn't come back, what does that do for you? What kind of feelings do you have about the guys who flew that mission?
Those men that were on that mission, they knew it was a one-way trip because they weren't going to be able to come back to the carrier. So they had to land after they ran out of fuel. It could have been any place where that happened after they bombed the city of Tokyo. And some of them landed in China, but I know that the Japanese managed to capture some of them and they executed them. So that's pretty hard to take, you know.
Yeah, they even executed a huge number of Chinese civilians who helped some of them escape. I mean, that's the horrible side of that story. But the big picture back in the States was, hey, America struck back and hit Japan's biggest city. When did you guys aboard the Northampton find out that that mission had been a success?
It was probably a week later that we got the news.
Did that mean something to you?
Well, it means that we had some pretty brave men doing it.
And for you, on your cruiser, if general quarters sounded, where did you have to go and what did you have to do?
My battle station during battle was a machine gun platform that we had above the foremast on a 50 caliber machine gun.
So the idea is you're firing at enemy planes that might be coming your way?
We had a lot of those. And of course, you never know if you shot it down or somebody else did because you've got a lot of other machine guns firing at the same airplane.
This may sound like a dumb question, but how much adrenaline is pumping through your system when you're up there on the foremast firing a 50 caliber machine gun at an airplane flying your way at 200 miles an hour or faster?
Yeah, that's pretty exciting when you got a man on either side of you on machine guns that a Japanese Zero fighter is firing at us and both of those men fall dead and you're still firing. You can't keep your mind on other things when you're concentrating on an airplane that's coming straight at you and know that he's firing to get you. But I lost two good friends, one on either side of me by this one airplane, and we finally knocked him out of the sky, though.
Where was that? Which battle was that?
That was in Midway. It's kind of hard to describe everything that went on. You're still in your battle position and firing at aircraft that's going every which way around there. They're trying to get to the aircraft carriers, so that's all I ever did during battle in the Midway.
It kind of sounds chaotic and I'm guessing exhausting.
Yeah, that lasted for 3 days, you know.
Did you ever get used to it? Did you ever get desensitized to it? Or was it as intense the entire time?
Yeah, you get to the point where it's just the same thing day after day and whatever happens, you don't get excited about it. You never have any fear. You learn to have no fear whatsoever because you're concentrating on taking out this objective in order to perform the obligation that you have. So my instructor explained that to me one time, that you can't have fear when you're in battle, because if you have fear of your life, then you're going to do something that will cause somebody else to get killed. It just becomes a daily routine. You don't get excited about it at all.
All of 18 years old. Wow. And I hope I'm not belaboring the point. If there's anything you don't want to talk about, feel free. But what about at night when you hit your bunk? Do you think, I don't know if I'm going to make it home from this war?
You worry at night about submarine and torpedoes. So that keeps you awake during the night.
And I guess I should ask you too. Is there anything you would like to say about those two young men who didn't get to celebrate their 100th birthday, much less a lot more?
Well, it is kind of sad to know that these people sacrificed their life for the objectives that they were ordered to perform. Yeah, you think about it, that they will never get to see their parents again or never get to do the things that they would have otherwise if they hadn't been killed in war.
And these were guys that you knew pretty well because you had the same job, you're in the same division?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah. I don't remember their names now.
I bet you can still see their faces.
I can see both of them very plain.
Well, thank you for being willing to help us understand what it's really like for you out there. Did you hear from home at all while you're out to sea?
Not very often. Our mail service is not very good when you're out to sea. We spent 91 days out to sea and never saw land.
That's enough to make you crazy right there.
Yes, it is.
And you just described some of what you had to do psychologically just to make it from day to day. But was there something that you thought was really instrumental in how you were able to handle it, how you were able to persevere and make it from one day to the next?
Oh, I guess the only thing I could add to that would be the training that we had by good instructors that were able to instill into us the importance of the job that we had to do.
And do you think it made a difference for you to have your cousin Roy aboard ship with you?
I don't think that made any difference. We were at different stations during all the battles that we were in, and so you just never think about the other person, I guess.
Well, from what I hear, it made a difference for him later on, but we'll get to that. You mentioned the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands. So this is October 1942, and I've interviewed a couple guys who were on the Hornet when that happened, and the Hornet sunk. A good friend of mine lost his eye when the Hornet was sunk and had to jump overboard holding his eyeball in the socket. It was hanging by the optic nerve. I've heard his perspective from the Hornet, but what was that battle like from your cruiser, the Northampton?
The battle itself was pretty well over by the time we got to it. We was engaged in another battle, and after that one ended, then we were ordered to the Santa Cruz Island battle. So when we got there, the battle itself was pretty well over with.
So when the Hornet gets sunk at the Santa Cruz Islands, I believe you guys were one of the ships that picked up some of their survivors, is that right?
Yes, we picked up some of the survivors that were off the Hornet. We backed up and hooked on to the Hornet with the big tow line, and we were going to tow her to Australia to get repaired. So that's where we had to abandon it because of a Japanese airplane that came in over top of us, a dive bomber, and so we had to break away from it in order to maneuver. And that dive bomber dropped a bomb. I'm sure it was meant for us, but it landed about 200 feet away from us. And of course, he was shot down.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to ask you about that. For people that may not be following here, correct me if I'm wrong, the idea here is, well, we're going to tow the Hornet. But if you're towing the Hornet, you're going a lot slower and a lot straighter, and you're kind of a sitting duck for the enemy yourselves, huh?
Yeah, that's true. We had the Hornet underway at 6 knots when that airplane showed up, and so then we had to abandon it.
And as you mentioned that, you know, Japanese plane coming in and dropping a bomb and it lands 200 feet away from your ship, is that something you saw from where you were, or you just heard about later?
I actually saw it right from the beginning. Yeah, I saw the airplane when he flew over the top of us and dropped the bomb. So we thought it was probably going to hit us, but it managed to miss us by about 200 feet.
Again, I'm not trying to be melodramatic. As I try to imagine what that feels like, seems like maybe a helpless feeling while you're watching that bomb fall, huh?
Yeah, you can see that bomb when he released it, and it's coming down over the top of you, and you wonder, is it going to hit us or is it going to miss us? You just never know. You stand by for a big explosion when that bomb hits the ship, but it didn't do it. And I was able to see it right from the beginning until the bomb exploded out in the water.
So the orders are, take this tow rope away. The Hornet's going to go under. The crew's already been rescued at that point, the survivors anyway. And then just a few years ago, they finally discovered the wreckage of the Hornet way down there. Did you hear about that when they found it?
I didn't hear about that because it was in deep water. I think I heard 16,000 feet, but I'm not sure of that. But it was in very deep water, but I didn't know they had discovered it.
It was actually 17,500 feet where the research vehicle Petrel discovered the wreckage of the Hornet in 2019. That might be a topic in a couple of weeks when we mark the 84th anniversary of the legendary Doolittle Raid on Tokyo. But Floyd Thomason's biggest trial by fire was still to come. We honor his legacy this weekend after his passing at age 102. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-530-3328.
On honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, celebrating the life of Floyd Thomason after his graduation to eternity at the age of 102. The Navy veteran was one of our last eyewitnesses to some of the most historic moments in America's early days of World War II.
So now it's been almost a year since the war started. You guys survived December of 41 and all these months into 42. You've just seen a ship that you're supposed to protect, the Hornet, get sunk. Are you starting to wonder when the number of the Northampton's going to get called?
Well, I had no idea, looking ahead to where I thought that we might get bombed and sunk or something, because we intercepted a Japanese transmission for their surface vessels and aircraft to sink the Hornet and the Northampton at all costs. And that's the way it was worded.
And that was because of the Doolittle raid?
Yes.
You guys were a target because of what you had done to them.
That's the way it seemed to me, yeah. So immediately after we were not able to do any more salvage work on the Hornet, we were ordered to break up a landing party over Guadalcanal at midnight. It was the blackest night I ever seen. Not a star was shining. It was like being in a cave. So when we arrived there, somewhere around midnight, we went into this, what they call the Straits of Tassafaronga. And that's where the Japanese were unloading supplies and ammunition and all the stuff for their troops that they had stationed there on the island. And that's where we got sunk. That was on the 30th of November, 1942.
And I think by now we've learned you've got a pretty clear memory about all these things. So if you're able, can you take us back to the 30th of November, 1942, and walk us through it moment by moment, how you experienced that night that could have ended your life, clearly.
When we entered the Straits of Tassafaronga, of course, we started firing onto the Japanese ships that were in the harbor there, unloading all of their supplies and troops. So Roy and I were stationed on the searchlights of our ship on Northampton. So I can see that just really vividly today, like it happened yesterday. All those Japanese ships on fire and sinking. And we lost several ships in there, too. Roy and I was on the searchlight platform working the searchlights when those two torpedoes hit us. I guess Roy was leaning back against the stanchion there, and when the torpedoes hit, of course, it lifted the ship and it injured his back. When the ship started sinking, we waited until it was over on its side pretty much, and we walked right down the side of the ship into the water. We didn't have to jump off of the ship. There may have been some of them that did. But when I got into the water, I heard somebody hollering for help. And so we had life jackets on, and so I swam over to the person that was needing some help, and it was Roy. He's my cousin. So I managed to get him on a piece of floating debris there, so where he was up out of the water, and I just hung on to it until morning, and we were picked up the next morning at daylight by one of our ships.
I have to ask, were you as calm while that was happening as you were just describing it to me now?
I think I was. I was pretty calm. I didn't get very excited about it.
How is that possible? How do you do that?
I don't know how that would happen, but you just get accustomed to it and know what's going to happen. And if it happens, well, I just accept it for what it is, you know.
Well, and that was something else I was going to ask. Had you kind of consciously or subconsciously prepared for that possibility that at some point your ship may get sunk and you may have to do something like that?
Oh, yeah. You're prepared for that all the time. Any emergency that might arise, why, you got to be prepared for it.
So with the ship listing over, the side is now the top, and you basically had a little staircase or a slide right down to the surface, huh?
Yeah, it was a kind of a slide. pretty steep slide. You could walk on it, and it was not too steep, but what you could walk on it, because it's almost laying on its side.
Well, and you said something else there. You stayed in the water all night, got rescued in the morning. It seems to me like there might have been a few things going on overnight, or at least some things going through your mind. What were those hours in the water like, and how long did that feel?
We probably spent 4 hours in the water. But I want to back up here just a little bit. When the torpedoes hit our ship, they exploded right where the engine room and all of our oil supply was. And so it caught on fire. And this fire went right up the main mast, and we had personnel stationed up and down it. Of course, all of those were perished, and you just stood there and watched and knowing that some of your good friends is burning to death and you can't do anything about it. Kind of hits you pretty hard in the heart, you know, and you have a lot of feelings for them. I had one good friend that lost his life there, and him and I made a pact with one another if either of us should die during the battles and everything that's going on out there before the war ended, that we were to go to the other person's parents and tell them what went on and how it happened, and to assure them that their son had passed away and would not be coming back, you know. And so I did that, and it was a good trip up to Montana.
What was that sailor's name?
His name was Bud Flesher.
And how long after the sinking of the Northampton did you get a chance to go see his family?
It was probably 2 years before I was able to get back up there to see them. I was out of the service at that time. And so my brother and I went up and spent a week with him.
And you've described to us a lot of things that none of us will ever go through. None of us ever have gone through. And we marvel at how you did what you did. But how hard was that compared to everything else you had to do to go to this sailor's parents and talk to them about what happened to their son?
That's pretty tough to have to do that, because his mother kept saying, I know one day he's going to come walking through that door. He's not dead. And I had a terrible time convincing her that he was not going to come home again. That she had to accept it that way. And so it's pretty tough to do.
Can't even imagine. And I also can't imagine spending 4 hours in the water, in the dark, with things floating around, enemy in the area. What was going through your mind for that time in the water?
The biggest problem I had was keeping Roy still. He wanted to wave his hand in the air, you know, to come and get me. And I kept telling him, no, don't do that. I said, there's enemy ships here. We don't want one of them to come and get us. Let's wait here till morning. And so I had him up on this piece of debris that was floating there. I think it was a hatch cover. So it had loops of rope around the edges of it, and I just run my arm through one of those loops, and I stayed in the water and kept him comfortable as I could up on top of that until morning. My main objective was to keep us safe from enemies that might have been in the area in another ship that might come up beside us and go ahead and shoot us. But we got through it.
And were there other sailors around you, or was it just the two of you in that area?
There was only the two of us in that immediate area.
I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes again. That's not a very encouraging position to be in. And I'm not trying to put thoughts in your mind, just an honest question. In situations like that, do you hope, ask, pray for divine intervention? Do you have an expectation that something beyond yourself is going to help you out?
Well, I never had any of those thoughts. I guess that I wasn't in tune with the Lord at that time, and so I just didn't have any prayers to say or anything. Of course, to explain that, my family was not raised as a religious family. We never had churches to go to, any religious teachings. So we weren't familiar with that too much, and that happened later in my life.
Well, I guess in light of that, I need to ask if you view all those events any differently now than you did then.
Oh, I definitely do. Yeah, I can see a lot of changes that I would make today that I didn't do then. And I think that's something that we all have thoughts of.
So you were smart enough to keep Roy from giving your position away and having the enemy pick you up. The moment when you saw a friendly ship coming your way, when you guys got rescued from the water, can you describe that for us, what that meant to you?
Well, that was a very happy moment as soon as I saw one of our ships coming to us. I reassured Roy that we were going to be saved by one of our ships. And I said, don't worry, we'll be safe. In a few minutes, they'll pick us up and take us aboard their ship.
Were you guys pretty tired and weak by that point, or still feeling pretty good?
Well, he was getting pretty weak because he had that back injury, but I was hanging on pretty good. Some people asked me, well, didn't you worry about sharks? And I said, no, didn't worry any about sharks. I never thought of them being around there at that time of the night, but maybe I should have.
So you survived again. Your ship didn't. What did the Navy do with you next?
From that point, we were picked up, and all the survivors of that battle were taken to New Hebrides Island. We were just put on land there and made a camp with whatever other ships could afford to give to us to keep us halfway comfortable and living, you know. We put up a bunch of tents, and there was probably 200 people there. And so we were stationed there for 2 months. From there, I was reassigned to New Caledonia. They had an aircraft base there in New Caledonia, and I was stationed at that.
Well, I want to hear about what you did the rest of the war, but another thing comes to mind, because communication then wasn't what it is now. Did your parents know what had happened to you?
No, they never knew what happened to me until I was able to contact them by mail after I got organized in New Caledonia. I was able to get a letter to them there, and that's the first notification. But even then, Paul, I couldn't describe what happened to me because of the secrecy of everything. You know, they read our mail, and before it ever was put into the post office, and so you had all this stuff that was blacked out that they thought that you shouldn't be writing about, you know, that the enemy might get a hold of. So it was difficult to describe them what happened at that time, and it's almost impossible. But all I could say was, I'm okay, so don't worry about me.
Well, before they got your letter, had they gotten a telegram that the ship had been sunk or that you were unaccounted for?
No, they didn't get any information like that.
You know, when you describe a sailor asking for help, it turns out it's your cousin Roy, and you're able to help him out and get him on that piece of debris. I'm not trying to get you to pat yourself on the back, but I'm just guessing that he probably had some gratitude for you as a result of that.
Oh, he definitely did. From that time on, every time I'd see him, he'd call me his hero. So maybe I was. I didn't feel like a hero, but anyhow, I'm just doing what I had to do. But I'm sure he recognized the fact that I maybe saved him from drowning and out there in the water a long way from home.
So you've described a lifetime of experiences for most of us, and that was really all in about 1 year's time from the start of the war. All these things happened for you. So as we know now, with the lens of hindsight, most of the war was still to come. So what did the Navy have you doing for the rest of World War II?
Well, after I was at New Caledonia for about a year and a half, then they assigned me to an aviation training station in Peru, Indiana, and that's where I served the rest of my time. I was discharged there.
Well, and there's probably a couple details there that I didn't ask you about, because I did see a picture of a pretty good-looking guy with some flight goggles on, and it says 1942 next to it. When did you start flying?
Well, that was in 1942, after I was reassigned to New Caledonia at the air base there. What happened here is that they were very short-handed on that particular base. They were flying PBY patrol bombers out of there to Australia, New Zealand, and then back home again, back to New Caledonia. And they needed co-pilots. Well, I'd never even been in an airplane before, you know, and they asked me some questions about flying and what I thought about it. Do I think that I would be able to handle an airplane as a co-pilot? And so I'm all gung-ho for this kind of stuff, you know, and I'm sure I'll go. And so that's where I wound up, and that's why I've got those aviation goggles and helmet and coat and stuff on.
So did you have to go through flight training and all that?
No, we did on board. Right now you go and you get your training in the air. But I had a pilot that was qualified, you know, and so he taught me all the things that I needed to know. But they would never let me land the airplane, because you have to land on water, you know, and I don't think I would do too good landing on water.
But later on, you got your private pilot's license.
Yes, after I got out of the service, my brother and I got our private license. We went to school over in Eugene, Oregon. So we got our pilot's license in 1953.
So I'm just curious, too. I mean, you're back in the States, and Peru, Indiana seems like a safer place than right off the coast of Guadalcanal or out in the middle of the Pacific. But when the war came to an end, when Germany surrendered, then a few months later Japan surrendered, was that significant to you?
Oh, yeah. I was happy to see that all come to an end. Because there were so many people that were losing their lives, men and women, you know, in the service at that time. And they had quite a few women over in Germany that lost their lives, too. And when we think about service people losing their lives in the war, we never think about the women that are involved there also. So you think about that.
And most of the people alive today didn't live through World War II. And the only thing they know about it is what they read, or maybe they'll see a movie, or maybe they're listening to you. So is there something that you would say we need to consider? Why it still matters today? Why it's significant what you and more than 16 million Americans did?
Well, yes, it's very significant to me. All of the wars that we have had and the people that lost their lives is very important to me because they were my brothers and sisters. You got to take that into consideration when you think about the people that are not surviving all of these things. So I hope that we never get into another one, but it looks like we may, but that's not for me to decide.
And is there something that you saw then, something about America then, or the guys you served with that provided an example you think we'd do well to follow now? Is there anything you think we can learn from that time period?
I think it's something that everybody should look back on, the survivors of World War II. Don't forget all the things that happened and the men that lost their lives and the material things that we had to sacrifice in order to win that war.
And I know you've been all over the world. I saw a picture from dredging the Dead Sea in Jordan to come up with some good materials, and you've operated equipment in all kinds of places. But you've also been back to Pearl Harbor. You and your wife went back decades after the attack. What was that experience like for you?
Well, going back to Pearl Harbor after so many years, everything had changed. It never looked like it did when I was there in 1941 and 42. All the buildings have been replaced with newer structures, and so some of the old ones that I knew were all gone.
Did you go out to the USS Arizona?
Yes, we all went out to the memorial that they have out there, and you can look down and see the ship underwater there. It was very exciting moment to look down and see that ship after all those years.
Well, I'm sure we could sit here for a few more days and you'd have more stories than we could handle, but there's something important I don't want to forget to say, and that's thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for sharing a story with us that nobody else could share with us. One question I like to ask, I don't know if it's an easy one to answer, but I'm interested in how you feel about it, because you've been here for over 100 years. If you think back over those 100 years, is there something that you would say you're most thankful for or most proud of?
I suppose, like most children that grow up in a big family, I'm very thankful for the good parents that I had to bring me to that stage in life. Growing up on a ranch was a great experience, and I think it helped me to be a better person and appreciate the things that has been given to me throughout the years. Otherwise, I'd probably not recognize them. I think the formative years when you are children are the greatest years in your life. I'm just thankful that I have lived as long as I have and had the experiences and the knowledge that I have received from these experiences I've had. So some of them have been good, some of them have been bad. Like everybody's life goes, it can't be perfect forever without having some problems in life. But our greatest thing that we have to live by is words of the Lord. He give us love for one another and the ability to forgive each other for the things that we might do that otherwise we wouldn't if we'd known it was going to happen that way. And I think that's about as all I can contribute to this life.
Was there anything that I didn't ask you about that you wanted us to know?
Our oldest son, Ronald, joined the Navy with one of his friends when we were living in Montana. He was blown off the aircraft carrier that they were serving aboard by a jet blast, and his body was never recovered. So we lost him. It was pretty tough for a while, but we got through it. It was during the Vietnam War.
From the loss of his ship in World War II to the loss of his son during the war in Vietnam to so many other challenges through 102 years, Floyd Thomason endured to his earthly finish line. Floyd Thomason kept enduring until his earthly finish line. Floyd Thomason kept persevering until his earthly finish line. And his memories that we had the privilege of listening to again remind us not only of why Tom Brokaw coined that term, the greatest generation, but also why we conclude this program with the same four words each and every week. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.